Today is Wednesday, August the 21st, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies and, of course, our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The Federal Trade Commission finally makes fake online reviews illegal. If you ever read an online review for a product or service and thought, this is too good to be true, you were probably right. On average, about 30% to 40% of online reviews are fake, according to estimates from consumer advocacy groups. But that will soon change as the era of fake online reviews is about to come to an abrupt end. The Federal Trade Commission has officially finalized a new rule which will go into effect in October of this year that will ban fake online reviews in several different ways. Fake reviews not only waste people's time and money, but also pollute the marketplace and divert business away from honest competitors, said Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan in a press release that announced the rule on August the 14th. What will the new rule do? Fake reviews can be generated through multiple controversial practices, which will be deterred under the new rule. First, the rule will prohibit reviews and testimonies from people who do not exist, which includes reviews that are generated by artificial intelligence, according to the press release. Also, reviews from individuals who never experienced the product, business, or service will be banned as well. In addition, the rule will block businesses from providing compensation or other incentives for positive or negative reviews. Also, insider reviews, such as those written by individuals who work for the company, will also be prohibited. Businesses will also no longer be allowed to use groundless legal threats, physical threats, intimidation, or certain false public accusations to prevent or remove a negative review from a consumer. They will also be banned from misrepresenting that a website or entity that they control provides independent reviews or opinions about a category of products or services, including their own. Lastly, intentionally buying or selling bots that generate fake followers or reviews for a social media account will also be barred under the new rule. According to the press release, those violating the FTC's new rule will face civil penalties. The Federal Trade Commission final version of this rule comes after it was first proposed in November of 2022. The move from the FTC appears to be part of President Joe Biden's latest effort to end corporate ripoffs, which involves promoting competition and protecting consumers in the American economy. Online reviews can make or break a business, so it is no surprise that some companies have resorted to using deceptive tactics to maintain a five-star rating. According to a recent survey from Coupon Birds, about 76% of consumers said they always check reviews before making an online purchase, and roughly 93% said that online reviews have impacted their buying decisions. Microsoft patches TPM 2.0 bypass to prevent Windows 11 installs on PCs with unsupported CPUs. Many users with officially unsupported PCs could successfully install Windows 11 using a trick that circumvents its hardware requirement verification process with a product server command line. It gave many older PC owners a new lease of life as they could migrate towards the latest operating system, as the older ones were no longer supported and were prompted to upgrade. However, Bob Pony quickly found that Microsoft had patched this trick in the latest Canary build, prompting the need for the TPM, that's the Trusted Platform Module 2.0 protocol. Pony confirmed that the current Windows 11 24H2 works fine with the bypass, though that may not be the case for long. The joy of using Windows 11 on officially unsupported PCs may end as Microsoft rolled out a patch in its Windows 11 Insider build 27686 that effectively blocks this trick. This command line had been used for almost a year, enabling many users to upgrade from earlier Windows versions effortlessly. While there are other methods, some were patched, such as PopCNT restriction implemented a few months ago. Until then, many could use Windows 11 on PCs using a wide range of older CPUs like the obsolete Athlon and Core 2 Duo. Though the PopCNT restriction was patched, the TPM and secure boot check could still be bypassed. This bypass is a simple command line that can be executed only during the OS installation process that permanently skips the hardware check, including the TPM and RAM verification. It was helpful as many PCs could efficiently run Windows 11, but couldn't with requirements such as TPM 2.0 protocol not being available in older systems. Even if one uses an add-on module, Windows 11 CPU compatibility begins from Intel's 8th generation and AMD Ryzen's 2nd generation CPUs. Installing a TPM chip wasn't possible on notebooks. For many users, these CPUs are far more obsolete. However, Microsoft have been quick to phase out older operating systems, and many prefer to move to the latest one. Not surprisingly, Microsoft hasn't mentioned this patch and removed this bypass ability. Though this was found in the Canary build, this will likely trickle down to future releases and be implemented for all systems once updated. This would force such users to switch to other operating systems, including Windows 11 LTSC Enterprise Edition, whose CPU compatibility list starts from 2-core CPUs with 1 GHz clock speed with TPM 2.0 optional. While there are other installation methods, it's simply a matter of time before Microsoft patches these bypasses. In this situation, users can switch to older Windows 10 with supported builds, shift to Linux, or make a hardware upgrade. In my most humble opinion, I would not bother to expend any more effort to find alternate ways to bypass TPM 2.0 when upgrading Windows 10 to Windows 11. Microsoft is enabling BitLocker device encryption by default on Windows 11. Clean installs of Windows 11 version 24H2 now have BitLocker device encryption enabled. Microsoft is making BitLocker device encryption a default feature in its next major update to Windows 11. If you clean install the 24H2 version that's rolling out in the coming months, device encryption will be enabled by default when you first sign in or set up a device with a Microsoft account or work or school account. Device encryption is designed to improve the security of Windows machines by automatically enabling BitLocker encryption on the Windows install drive and backing up the recovery key to a Microsoft account or extra ID. In Windows 11 version 24H2, Microsoft is reducing the hardware requirements for automatic device encryption, opening it up to many more devices, including ones running the home version of Windows 11. Device encryption no longer requires Hardware Security Test Interface, with the acronym HSTI, or modern standby, and encryption will also be enabled even if untrusted direct memory access, that's a DMA, buses, interfaces are detected. The latest Windows 11 version 24H2 update comes pre-installed on Microsoft range of Copilot Plus PCs and is expected to be available on existing machines in late September. That means if you clean install Windows 11 later this year or buy a new PC with 24H2 installed, BitLocker device encryption will be enabled by default. If you just upgrade to 24H2, Microsoft won't enable device encryption automatically. The feature could impact solid-state device performance on some devices. Tom's Hardware article tested this software version of BitLocker last year and found it could slow drives up to 45%. Microsoft was asked since early May to comment on BitLocker device encryption being enabled by default, but the company has only confirmed its plans through support documents where there is no mention of any potential performance impacts. You'll need a Microsoft account to enable device encryption. You can avoid automatic device encryption if you're using a local account on a clean Windows 11 version 24H2 install. When you first set up a new machine and log in with a local account, you'll be prompted to sign in with a Microsoft account to finish encrypting the device. BitLocker can still be manually enabled using the BitLocker control panel on local accounts, though you can also disable device encryption through a toggle in the privacy and security section of Windows 11's setting interface. Microsoft set out to improve security in Windows 11 in a meaningful way by requiring modern processors, Secure Boot, and TPM, which is a Trusted Platform Module chips. These requirements, while controversial, allow Microsoft to also enable its virtualized memory integrity feature by default 2 years ago to better protect Windows 11 systems from malicious code. In my humble opinion, BitLocker can slow drives up to 45%. That's a very hefty price to pay for encryption. If you feel that this is overly bearing, disable it after you get a new machine or after a new install. Microsoft will automatically archive unlicensed OneDrive business accounts, effective January 2025, and charge a small reactivation fee if you chose to reactivate it. Microsoft will automatically archive unlicensed OneDrive business accounts from January 2025 and impose a 60 cent per gigabyte reactivation fee. Microsoft recently announced critical changes to its storage policies for unlicensed OneDrive accounts. The company will start archiving unlicensed OneDrive accounts from January 2025. For context, this will apply to accounts that have remained unlicensed for over 90 days. Users won't have access to their unlicensed OneDrive accounts once archived. The only way around this is through admins who will be required to enable unlicensed account billing in the Microsoft 365 Admin Center. It's worth noting that archive unlicensed accounts will attract a monthly fee of 5 cents per gigabyte for storage in the Microsoft 365 archive. Users will also need an additional 60 cents per gigabyte to reactivate archive accounts, which could take up to 24 hours. Microsoft says unlicensed OneDrive accounts pose a great security threat in enterprise environments. An unlicensed account can cause confusion and occasionally lead to duplication. The company details that an unlicensed account will exist within a tenant if it falls under the retention policy, which prevents deletion or lack of a valid license. To this end, Microsoft recommends navigating to SharePoint Admin Center reports, OneDrive accounts to check the list of unlicensed accounts. Users with unlicensed OneDrive accounts are advised to take necessary precautionary measures to avoid setbacks. commercial customers should be able to check the number of unlicensed accounts and the reasons why they are unlicensed from August 16, 2024. The FCC, that's the Federal Communication Commission, proposes requiring robocallers to disclose when they're using artificial intelligence. Robocallers will have to reveal they're using the tech on every AI-generated call. The Federal Communications Commission proposed a new set of rules this past week that would require robocallers to disclose when they're using artificial intelligence for phone calls and text messages. The proposal builds on the FCC's ban on making AI-generated robocalls without the express prior consent of the person being called. The agency now hopes to require callers to say, while seeking that consent, whether they plan to use AI for future calls and messages. Similar disclosures would have to be added to any AI-generated phone calls, which the agency says contain an enhanced risk of fraud and other scams. The regulator suggests defining an AI-generated call as any that uses technology to create an artificial or pre-recorded voice or a text using computational technology or other machine learning, including predictive algorithms and large language models, to process natural language and produce voice or text content to communicate with a called party over an outbound telephone call. Finally, the agency hopes to carve out an exception for when those with speech and hearing disabilities use AI-generated voice software to help them communicate on outbound phone calls. The FCC would also require that there be no unsolicited advertisement in such calls and that people on the receiving end of phone calls not be charged for them. The agency asked for specific comments on whether scammers could abuse the exception and how it could update its rules to prevent that. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and some of the things that actually cross over between home and small office, and even on up into some of the medium-sized offices. And in this case, I'm talking about the world of network-attached storage. We refer to these as NAS or NAS devices, and I've been exploring this world recently. I've actually been into this a few times in the workplace and dealing with delivering these devices into situations where multiple servers need to access the same data, or even situations where one server needs to access a bunch of hard drive space, but another server also needs hard drive space, and another server needs hard drive space, and you use this shared space, which also is redundant, meaning if one of the drives fails, we have all of the extra space there. We can pop out that failed drive, put in another drive, and it works out great. So Synology was really kind enough to send me one of their Synology 923 Plus units. And they send it out with some hard drives to allow me to put it through its paces. And this experience has been quite good for me. I've dealt with this hardware before, as NAS, Network Attached Storage, has been around for a while. Now, it's really starting to show itself as an ideal replacement for things like Windows servers. So many different small offices or even at home, we have this desire to have this storage space out on our network. And this storage space serves as a location for us to put backups and for us to put all kinds of data, like all of our photos and in some cases movies and whatever else. We can put this all on this series of hard drives. It works out really nice when we have that out on the network, but we start looking at the prices of these file servers, and I'm going to get into that here in a few minutes, and there's a certain resistance point here. We go, do I really want to spend that much money? So for basic purposes, a NAS is a device that is similar to that file server, but it's focusing really on the basic needs of file storage. Yes, it's got a number of other great features, but best of all is the ease of use. Now, I've talked about servers being key for offices, and there are setbacks. Okay, the computational power that is behind a lot of these Windows servers that we get these days is far more than most anybody is going to need. Now, we start also talking about, when we deal with these servers, we start talking about maintenance that's required, and you have to have knowledgeable server techs. You also have to figure out placement for something that is the size of a large desktop. You don't want to put it on a desk because it's going to be just occupying this huge amount of space. And it starts to break down as far as an idea getting a server in most of your smaller offices. I'm talking, if you've got 10, 15 people in the office, you don't want to occupy a big, huge room that has special cooling on that and all of that. You really need to deal with something that's going to be smaller, doesn't put out a lot of heat, something that's going to be quiet. As a matter of fact, I've had this Synology 923 Plus sitting here in my office. I can actually record. It is absolutely whisper quiet. Now, I told you I was going to talk about pricing on this. So I priced out the Synology 923 Plus with a simple tower server from Dell, and I configured it with a bare amount of memory, the same hard drive space, hot swap hard drives, basically the hardware configured just like the Synology 923 Plus. The base price for the server, just the base price, the hardware, was a few hundred dollars more for getting to that Dell. But the Dell server also required Microsoft Windows licensing, something called client access licenses, which is for every different workstation you're connecting on up to it, you have to spend another however much, $50, $100. And that just started driving the price up so much further. The Synology NAS doesn't require anything more on those licenses. It doesn't require Windows. It doesn't require all of the maintenance and the knowledge of dealing with the Windows server operating system. So again, I mentioned it's 4 feet away from me, and it's nearly silent. It has a 100-watt power supply, and the ease of setup and use can be learned by anyone who's comfortable with a web browser in just a matter of a couple of hours of YouTube videos. The Dell server, 600-watt power supply. I've had a number of these. They're loud enough that you don't want it in the same room. And that learning curve, oh, that learning curve is rough. Windows administration classes, for instance, are a few days long. They're specialized, and you don't use the knowledge often enough so that it winds up getting stale. There's upsides. You can duplicate the same data into a backup location, or there's another fun approach, multiple locations sharing the same data. This works out well with offices all having a local copy to the top most important documents in the office. And the Synology NAS has all of this kind of stuff built in. Now, there is going to be a bit of an issue if you start talking live programs, accessing databases, or when multiple people in different locations have to access the same file at the same time. But in the small office, that's less likely. I'm really, really thrilled with this whole idea of the Synology 923 Plus and some of its sister units. So by all means, check it out. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. When something is free, someone is paying for it. When big tech offers free services and free products, it is not free if you are the product. The idea of free services often comes with hidden costs. Companies like Google, Facebook, and others provide services that are free to use, such as social media platforms, search engines, and cloud storage. Instead of charging users directly, these companies often monetize their services by collecting user data. This data is then used to create targeted advertising, which can be far more lucrative. When you use these free services, your personal information, preferences, and behaviors are collected. This data can be sold to advertisers or used to enhance their own marketing strategies. The more data a company has about you, the better they can target ads to your interest, leading to higher conversion rates for advertisers. Many users are unaware of how much data is being collected and how it is used. This raises significant privacy and ethical concerns. It's essential for users to be aware of these dynamics, understanding that free often means that personal data is the currency can help users make informed decisions about which services to use. While big tech companies offer a variety of free services, it's crucial to recognize that you might be paying with your personal data. Being informed about these practices allows you to navigate the digital landscape more effectively. The free service from big tech companies is also a form of customer acquisition. Free services offered by big tech companies are often a strategic form of customer acquisition. Many tech companies utilize freemium models where basic services are offered for free while premium features are available for a fee. This approach allows users to experience the product without any initial investment, making it more likely for them to convert to paying customers later. By providing free services, companies can rapidly build a large user base. This is crucial for platforms that rely on network effects, where the value of the service increases as more people use it. The cost associated with acquiring a new customer can be significant. Companies often invest heavily in marketing and promotional strategy to attract users. Offering free services can lower the initial barrier to entry, making it easier to convert users into paying customers later. Once users are engaged with a free service, companies can focus on enhancing user experience and retention, which can lead to higher lifetime value for each customer. While free services may seem like a generous offering, they are often a calculated strategy for customer acquisition. By attracting users with no upfront cost, big tech companies aim to convert them into loyal customers over time, leveraging their data and engagement to drive revenue. Understanding this dynamic can help users navigate their choices in the digital landscape more effectively. In the personal computing industry, we've learned that when you are offered a free service or product by big tech, at some point in time, it will no longer be free. In the personal computing industry, the notion that free services from major tech companies often come with hidden costs is a well-recognized phenomenon. Users frequently find themselves dependent on these services, which can lead to challenges when the free offerings change or are withdrawn. Many users become reliant on free services, such as cloud storage or social media platforms, without considering the potential consequences. For instance, once a user exceeds the storage limit on a service like Google Drive, they may find that their access to connected services is restricted until they either upgrade to a paid plan or manage their storage more effectively. This situation illustrates how users can inadvertently lock themselves into a service, making it difficult to transition away when costs arise. The concept of vendor lock-in is crucial here. It refers to the strategies employed by tech companies to make it challenging for users to switch to alternative services. This could lead to monopolistic behaviors where companies can dictate terms and pricing once they have captured a significant market share. As competition diminishes, users may find themselves facing higher costs for services that were once free. As companies evolve, many are moving away from purely free models to hybrid or subscription-based services. This shift often reflects a need for sustainable revenue streams, but it can leave users feeling trapped if they have built their digital lives around these platforms. The transition from free to paid services can be abrupt, catching users off guard and forcing them to reconsider their options. While free services from big tech companies can be appealing, they often come with strings attached. Users should be mindful of their dependence on these services and consider the long-term implications of vendor lock-in and potential costs associated with transitioning to paid models. Being proactive about understanding these dynamics can help users maintain greater control over their digital lives. As companies evolve, many are moving away from purely free models to hybrid or subscription-based services. This shift often reflects a need for sustainable revenue streams, but it can leave users feeling trapped if they have built their digital lives around these platforms. The transition from free to paid services can be abrupt, catching users off guard and forcing them to reconsider their options. While free services from big tech companies can be appealing, they often come with strings attached. Users should be mindful of their dependence on these services and consider the long-term implications of vendor lock-in and potential costs associated with transitioning to paid models. Being proactive about understanding these dynamics can help users maintain greater control over their digital lives. The notion that someone is paying for it serves as a reminder to look critically at free offerings. Understanding the underlying business models and potential costs associated with these services can empower users to make informed choices about where they invest their time and data. Have smartphones replaced digital cameras? The modern photographic landscape looks vastly different than it did 25 years ago. Before, about the year 2000, photography was exclusively an analog medium. Digital photography existed, but not in the way we perceive it today. However, as technology advanced, the digital camera became more and more capable of providing the sorts of image we had come to expect from film photography. And now, everyone carries a camera with them, everywhere they go. So why buy a dedicated camera system when smartphones are so widely available? Technology has advanced at such a fast pace, and it seems like we may now be entering a new era of photography with the inclusion of AI into cameras, whether smartphones or not. Many people bought cameras over the years, and sales skyrocketed when digital cameras were introduced into the market. But it doesn't mean that more people were buying cameras. It means that photography was becoming more accessible to people because of the shift in technology advancements, an increase in market demand that was never there prior. At about the same time that the original iPhone was released in 2007, you see a sharp drop in digital camera sales, but a continuing slope along an extrapolated vector of smartphone sales. People were no longer buying digital cameras since their smartphones already had cameras on them. And in the past 10 years or so, smartphones have become almost as good as digital cameras at taking photos. But that still doesn't really answer the question, are dedicated digital cameras still relevant today? The answer is, at least from my point of view, yes, of course. Smartphones have replaced cameras in every real sense that matters. Camera sales are down. Smartphone sales continue to rise. So it seems like smartphones won the war on photography. How many photographs do you see daily that were taken with a smartphone? While it's difficult to determine the exact number, aside from the obvious ones shared on social media, which we're also viewing on our smartphones. Anytime that photography matters, I don't believe you pull out a smartphone and consider that professional photography. For your wedding, you wouldn't want to hire someone who shows up with their smartphone. For movie posters or glamour shots, you don't use your iPhone. You may have taken a ton of photos on your smartphone, but let me ask this, how many of those are framed on your wall? The digital camera boom of the 2000s created a new market of casual photographers. People are taking more photos of their kids than they'll ever look at it again. They're also taking photo images of their food or pets or everyday life that may be posted to social media and then forgotten. Photography used to be about capturing an image that would last forever. While that remains true for many people, it's now also common to share something funny that you come across or send a photo of your fridge contents to your spouse while they're grocery shopping. It is not exactly long-lasting memories, but more an act of convenience. Are digital cameras still relevant? Smartphones have not replaced cameras. They have supplemented the need for photography for millions of people. They have created a new reason to take photographs and exponentially made accessible the ability to take photographs of whatever you want for whatever reason you want. What used to be a skill, the chore of developing film is no longer an issue. And as such, it has created the capacity for countless other people, including a new generation of people that never even knew non-digital cameras, to learn and love photography for themselves. The unofficial Forever Keyboard. Logitech CEO Hanneke Faber had mentioned the possibility of a Forever mouse being a subscription-based product with the aim of increasing the longevity of its products through more premium devices that can be updated over time. However, there are no current plans to release such a product, and Logitech has stated that it will continue selling its existing mice, which are owned for the life of the mouse after purchase. It's important to note that while the concept has been discussed, there are no concrete plans to release a Forever mouse at this time. The idea has generated mixed reactions, with some expressing skepticism about the concept of paying for ongoing updates for a physical product. Well, this brought to mind that I've been using a Forever keyboard on my desktop systems. This is in contrast to my experience with laptop keyboards. I have been known to have a heavy hand when, well, entering data via the keyboard. Many people claim that I pounce on the keyboard too heavily. I have changed keyboards on more than one notebook. Although not officially introduced as a Forever keyboard, the original IBM PC-AT keyboard certainly qualifies. This keyboard has never failed me. It is of very sturdy construction. The original IBM PC-AT keyboard, introduced in 1984, is often regarded as a benchmark in keyboard design due to its sturdy construction and reliable performance. This keyboard was a significant upgrade over its predecessors, featuring a more user-friendly layout and improved functionality. The PC-AT keyboard introduced a more logical arrangement of keys compared to earlier models. For instance, the function keys were positioned in two rows on the left side rather than along the top, which many users found more intuitive. Users have noted that this keyboard has never failed, highlighting its robust build quality. The materials and design contributes to its longevity, making it a favorite among enthusiasts even decades after its release. Many of the keyboards from this era, particularly the Model M, utilized a buckling spring mechanism. This design not only provided tactile feedback, but also ensured that the keys had a satisfying resistance, making typing a more enjoyable experience. The original IBM PC-AT keyboard set a standard that many modern keyboards strive to emulate. Its design principles have influenced countless subsequent models, and it remains a popular choice among retro computing enthusiasts and professionals who appreciate its reliability and feel. The original IBM PC-AT keyboard is celebrated not just for its historical significance, but also for its enduring quality and user satisfaction. A postscript of note, I know there are some people who would like to buy the original IBM PC-AT keyboard. They're not easy to find. The flexibility of upgrading a desktop PC is minimal today. The idea that you can simply upgrade one component sounds great on paper, but in many cases it can result in where you effectively end up buying a whole new computer in pieces. This happens because upgrading one component of your computer can unbalance the system. Now, adding more RAM or storage usually doesn't present this issue, And of course, you can upgrade these in most laptops anyway. But the core performance components aren't so benign. Let's say that you just significantly upgraded your GPU. If you were getting the most out of your CPU with your previous GPU, there's a good chance that your new GPU would be held back by your older component. So now you need a new CPU, or some percentage of your new GPU's performance is wasted. Except getting a new CPU that's worth the upgrade usually means getting a new motherboard, which might also require new RAM, and so on. Of course, upgrading like this has the benefit of spreading the cost of the total upgrade over time, with lopsided performance in the interim. But when this happens, it's a little different from just buying a whole new computer. It's true that in some parts of your computer can persist through multiple upgrade cycles, which may seem like a win. However, these components are things like the chassis, power supply, and perhaps your storage devices, assuming they aren't too slow to keep up with your other new components. These usually make up a pretty small percentage of the cost of a system. So overall, you're not gaining that much compared to simply selling your old system or trickling it down to a friend or relative as a complete working machine and putting the funds towards a new one. Then again, sometimes you can get more for a computer by selling its parts individually rather than as a whole. Unless you're one of the tiny percentage of computer enthusiasts who need the latest components no matter what, it doesn't make sense to upgrade every second or even third generation of components. If you're waiting half a decade for something worth upgrading to appear, then chances are you're going to replace every part of your computer anyway. While AMD has done a phenomenal job of keeping the same CPU sockets and making motherboard chipsets compatible over many generations, the simple fact is that Intel currently holds 80% of the desktop CPU market. When it comes to Intel CPUs, you're lucky to get two generations of compatibility these days. So if you want a worthwhile upgrade on the CPU side, that upgrade death spiral is practically guaranteed. Desktop computers have many real relevant advantages. It's the only way to get the best absolute performance as well as the best performance per dollar. It's much easier and cheaper to repair or replace faulty components, and you can indeed use the desktop form factor to spread the cost of building a PC out over time by, for example, buying a cheap GPU now and getting a better one later. However, the idea of spending good money on a PC today with the promise of extending its life far into the future is a more comforting illusion than something most people will actually do. Ask yourself this: how much of your current desktop computer has components from your PC from 5 years ago? What about 10 years ago? Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, what do you have for us this week?
Well, you know, the webcam.
Yeah.
It's so old and so ubiquitous that when somebody tries to bend the metal a little bit, it gets kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And at a recent trade show, I ran into Logitech's latest, got to talk to their lovely PR lady who had only been an email signature before.
Yeah. I love doing that. I love meeting people that I've exchanged emails for years. And yeah.
Indeed,
yeah.
Well, They had a new thing that they were offering that was for big conference rooms, and it would automatically switch to the right camera and do that.
Yes.
I said, never mind. Let's talk about one guy at a desk.
Yeah.
So I had them send me their up-a-step webcam, the Logitech MX Brio 705 for business.
Okay.
All right. It's some good news, some disappointments. But regardless, many of you will want one.
Uh-huh.
The imager is the best part. A 4K camera powered by Sony Starvis, Starvis technology. Use your browser for details.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of cool. They backlight. This is for sensitivity. They backlight the array of pixels in the sensor. So it takes less light coming in the lens to trigger it to the next level.
Okay.
Okay. So they're up biasing the light level. It's the trick I don't think I've seen since the 1970s when you needed a deck mini computer to deal with it. Their backlight is a sensitivity head start. It means it takes less light to trigger, so a wider dynamic range.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you can deal with less light ambiently that is still triggering it. And if you get more light, it knows how to electronically squint, I guess, is what yeah, okay. we would say. And by the way, it's got color response even in faint light. There's autofocus. There's an ultra-wide 4.3 megapixel sensor that auto-frames to focus on you by shifting which part of the pixel map it sends to your computer.
Wait. So it's moving around. It's adjusting. If you lean to the left or to the right while it's watching you,
that's the part of the picture it sends.
Okay, yeah. Nice.
It doesn't have to move to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one more trick that's kind of cool. It mounts on top of the monitor, like many webcams, a little clampy kind of thing. You know.
Okay. All right.
With this one, the camera's on a swivel. So if you want to put something on your desktop to show the people.
Okay. All right.
It's
yeah.
It's pointing down to let them see it. And, you know, that it's a lot better than saying, hey, let's frame share.
Yeah.
You know, now, my one and only disappointment.
Yes.
The Logitech PR Pro that I talked to, I said, look, webcams, I've tried a whole bunch. I've had a lot of Logitech.
Yes.
I usually default to Logitech. But I haven't yet found a webcam that successfully lets me bring in one of those synthetic backgrounds without the hair sizzle showing off that it's a fake.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, I see people doing that all the time. And, you know, sometimes it's like you see their face, but you see like half of their hair. Now, I don't have that problem. I don't have that problem with hair sizzle at all. For the audience, I have no hair.
He has hair. He just takes it off when it shows up.
Shave daily. Yes.
I said, will there still be scalp sizzle? She said, I don't think so. She said, I think it's good enough to get away with it.
Okay.
Okay. And turns out it wasn't any better than any of the other webcams. So you still mm-hmm. get scalp sizzle. So, you know, you bet. The good outweighs the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And you might want to check out the Logitech MX Brio 705 for business. It's about $200.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, put a hat on.
Of course, there's always my way. Just grab a razor from headblade.com. That's the actual company. And they make a little, it's like a little Hot Wheel that I run over the top of my head. Matchbox, whatever you want to call it.
All in a lather.
So we've got about a little less than a minute and a half left. Do you honestly think we're ever going to get to the point where they're going to eliminate the hair sizzle?
I think there is a way to do it, and I don't think it's implemented yet. Should I share the secret?
Sure.
Lighting.
Okay.
I think better lighting from the bezel,
mm-hmm.
and not just the broad ring light that gets diffused out, but something sure. that kind of is inspired by studio lighting.
Okay. All right.
You know, puts a light on the face, on the cheeks, you know, if you put the palm of your hand on your lips and your fingertips on your eyebrows, that's the area you most want to light.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I think with the right light there, the contour of your head with hair on it will be separated, optically separated from the background, and it will be easier for, shall we put it, the stupid electronics in the webcam to finally know there's a border there.
So someday somebody's going to listen to you and we will be finally able to put those really cool backgrounds and nobody will ever know.
But for a few $1,000, you can get a lead curtain and put it back there and put the fake background there. And
sure.
Why try to do it in the camera? You know?
There you go. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, August the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. Tech Ed Connect. Tuesday, September the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. In-person general meetings are back. Scarsdale Public Library, 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York. Zip code 10583. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. WPCUG.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.